welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're going to be, well, wrapping up the week a little bit, but I think looking at some of the broader implications about many of the things that have been taking place here over the past few days. But before we can move on. Well, significant changes to the American healthcare system seemed off the table, but now it looks like the Trump administration is not giving up the fight. Recently, the president made a few moves here, continuing what appears to be a Republican war on anything that seems like it could even slightly, maybe, possibly be universal healthcare or the road to it or pretending to be it, whatever. Now, principally, Trump seems to be threatening to cut off the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare subsidies, to try to force the collapse of the insurance exchanges and increase the number of uninsured people. This is one of those aspects of the Affordable Care Act that's also worth reflecting on, and how really the whole bill itself was a Frankenstein monster kind of bill that opened up the opportunity to potentially, maybe in the right circumstances, build towards universal health care, but also opened up all sorts of line of attack that could take us right back to the status quo. And in the type of conservative environment we are now in, almost certainly any changes is going to result in many people losing health care, almost certainly millions, if not tens of millions. So what is actually happening here? Well, there's a provision in the Affordable Care Act that insurers were required to provide discounts on the cost of health care for certain individuals in a lower income bracket. And then in exchange for that, the government would pay them a subsidy to help make up the difference. There are about 7 million people who received these subsidies, and last year it cost about $7 billion to provide them. However, the law did not actually have language tying the subsidies to any particular funding source, which House Republicans and then a federal judge said were unconstitutional. However, the judge gave the government time to appeal. The Obama administration did appeal, and many people felt that the government ultimately will prevail if they decide to continue with the case. So what Trump is trying to do is craft a Republican consensus around the idea of not funding the subsidies and not fighting for them in court, which would end them. Insurers, though, would still legally be required to offer the discounts, which means that two things are going to happen. Some insurers would just flee the markets and get out of these marketplaces overall, and others are just going to jack their prices up on everyone to make up the difference in what they lost in the government subsidy. Now, the Kaiser Family Foundation did a bit of an estimate and found that overall, if this change went through, the cost of healthcare for the average person would go up 19% on average, but probably more than that in a lot of places. And some places may actually just have no insurers inside of their market because they will flee, and that would mean they had zero healthcare options, which obviously would mean they had no healthcare. So why would Trump even do this? Well, his hope and what he says is that he's hoping that this catastrophic reality will force Democrats to negotiate with him to do some sort of bipartisan repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which seems massively unlikely since no compromise will ever pass with enough Republican support that doesn't result in a major loss of insurance running somewhere into the tens of millions of people, which, of course, Democrats are never going to go for. So a major showdown is set up for late April here when Congress has to pass a spending bill. House Republican leaders have waffled a bit, though, on this issue and seem to not have much appetite for ending the subsidies. So they may actually just go ahead and undercut Trump's negotiating position and fund them anyway. Certainly, they've been kind of speaking to that. So pretty soon, we're going to see if the Republicans have the stomach to tank health care for millions of people in what is almost certainly a futile attempt to pass a law that also will tank healthcare for millions of people. The Environmental Protection Agency has decided to stop the implementation of a rule aimed at limiting the dumping of toxic waste into water. Oh, wow. Hell of a thing to say. The rule, which is now being paused, would have required power plants starting in 2018 to certify they were using the most up-to-date technology to remove heavy metals from their waste. These metals include lead, arsenic, and mercury. Yes, things that I don't think I want to drink. And this is pretty relevant because coal power plants in particular are discharging quite a bit of this waste close to water you drink. In fact, just over one-third of coal power plants discharge wastewater within 5 miles of a downstream community's drinking water intake. And it's this coal ash that contains a lot of this, all the chemicals just mentioned, even more. There's 75 million tons of it created every year. They mix it with water a lot of times and put it in these sludge ponds, which then leak into the groundwater and then poison your water. How much is 75 million tons? That's 17 Superdome-sized, Superdome in New Orleans, 17 Superdome-sized stadiums. It's a lot of coal ash, a lot of mercury and arsenic probably going in your water. But now, however, the EPA is making sure power plants do not have to do their best to keep their highly polluted waste products out of your water. Well, we talk a lot on this show about the various uses and abuses of the law. So we have to tell you about what is really just an outstanding example of the abuses of the law perpetrated by, just stick with me here, believe it or not, NASA. So Joanne Davis is the widow of Robert Davis. Now, he was a NASA engineer who was integral to the Apollo 11 mission, which is the one where, for the first time, humans walked on the moon. Now, as a result of his service, Davis was got a little piece of moon rock the size of a grain of rice and a tiny little sliver of the Apollo 11 heat shield. You know, nice little memento for working there, making it happen. So unfortunately, after he passed, Miss Davis encountered hard times. Her son became so ill, he required 20 surgeries, and her daughter died. So she's in her 70s, 74. She now has to take care of several grandchildren unexpectedly and by herself. So both these mementos, they're encased inside paperweights, so she figured, why not sell these paperweights, get a little extra help with the increased cost of taking care of her family. Now, brokers didn't seem that interested, so she wrote to NASA asking if they could help her sell them. The NASA Inspector General's office, though, decided that Miss Davis was a criminal trying to sell stolen property. Of course, the property was not stolen, but that didn't stop them from moving forward with a sting operation. They got a confidential informant to call Miss Davis, pretend to be a buyer, set up a meeting at a Denny's, I believe. So the exchange takes place. It's like one of these drug deal things. Right after she hands over the moon piece, she gets the money. These guys stand up. They say that they're NASA federal agents undercover or whatever they say. The main investigator was a guy named Norman Conley. I just have to read you directly from the court documents what took place after they did the little handover. So here we go. Quote, Connolly announced himself as a special agent, and another officer's hand reached over Davis, grabbed her hand, took the moon rock paperweight. Then an officer grabbed Davis by the arm, pulling her from the booth. At this time, Davis claimed she felt like she was beginning to lose control of her bladder, and one of the officers took her purse. Now, the Washington Post explains the rest of the story thusly. She kept telling the officers she needed to use the bathroom. Undeterred, they continued walking her to the parking lot for interrogation. She then urinated in her clothes. She was soaked in urine visibly. Still, they continued interrogating her in the restaurant parking lot for between an hour and a half to 2 hours. They read her Miranda rights, ultimately allowed her to leave, and referred the case to the U.S. attorney in Orlando. There was never a crime, of course. She didn't steal the artifacts. Ultimately, the investigation was closed when the prosecutor in Orlando declined to bring a case. Again, this is a 74-year-old grandmother trying to support her family by doing something that wasn't even illegal. So now Miss Davis is suing the officers who entrapped her. What comes of it? Who knows? But here you go. Once more, one more time. Just one of the thousands upon thousands of examples of the thuggish police practices routinely allowed here in the United States of America. And in what I felt was fairly ridiculous and showboating press conference that took place yesterday, CIA director, former Kansas Congressman Mike Pompeo took aim at WikiLeaks. He called WikiLeaks a, quote, hostile intelligence service. He went on to say that they had produced, quote, nothing of value. He then just went on to say that they were cozying up to dictators and that they are a propaganda tool of Russia. So the usual stuff. But honestly, I have to say, pretty funny, given how the Trump campaign was having a WikiLeaks love fest there when their activities were revealing the truth about the Clinton campaign. Not so much now, though, that the WikiLeaks is revealing CIA's cyber weapons development program and the fact that the CIA lost complete control over all of these extremely destructive cyber weapons, but, you know, neglected to tell any of us. Now, of course, WikiLeaks has actually produced quite a bit. The Snowden leaks, obviously, is one that exposed the Orwellian mass spying the government does on Americans and really the entire world. But I think it's worth remembering here again the revelations that came to WikiLeaks from Chelsea Manning. I think we forget a lot of these things. The collateral murder video, which showed an Apache helicopter gunship shooting unarmed civilians. 11 people ultimately died. Two of them were Reuters journalists. And it was a big deal because Reuters had called for an investigation at the time. And the Americans were like, oh, it didn't happen. Never killed anybody. And this proved that it was a lie. And they had actually deliberately killed civilians. Some of them actually laughing while they did it. Also revealed in those same documents, an explicit order by U.S. forces in Iraq to ignore torture. The complicity of the U.S. defense contractor DynCorp being involved in child sex trafficking, which is a crazy story. You have to read it yourself. And also, This is very relevant. The U.S. government documents that when actually Hillary Clinton, of all people, was in the State Department, they were colluding with sweatshop owners to keep Haiti's minimum wage below $5 a day. I don't know. That seems like that's all very valuable to me. And now, of course, we have the revelations into the CIA's previously unknown cyber weapons program that has developed all sorts of capabilities that actually made devices of tens of millions of people far less safe, just so the CIA could maintain a backdoor for surveillance in a handful of actually hypothetical cases. Julian Assange seemed pretty nonplussed, though, by Mike Pompeo. He released a statement more or less trolling the CIA for not having a pretty stellar record themselves. But perhaps the biggest response from WikiLeaks can be seen from the fact that this morning they went ahead and released the most recent piece of information regarding CIA cyber weapons. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined in studio by many of our recent guests here. This is our 200th episode here today. So we're going to be here with these three guests for the hour. We have Brian Weaver, who's the founder and executive director of Hoop Sagrada, China Dickerson, who's the executive director of the District of Columbia Young Democrats, and Jamal Muhammad, aka DJ One Love, to those of us who know him well, the host of the Love Lounge on We Act Radio. Thank you all for joining the show.
Glad to be here again, especially for 200?
200.
Congratulations.
200. Nice. Thank you. Yes. Thank you. I mean, I guess when you're doing five shows a week, you know, 200 starts to add up, but here we are, still here. But let's just jump right into the conversation here. I mean, one of the things I've been thinking a lot about over the past, I don't know, week or so, has been Martin Luther King. And principally because the Syria strike that Trump launched was like 2 days after the Beyond Vietnam speech anniversary, which, I don't know, maybe that's not relevant at all, but to me it seemed very relevant for something like that to be happening so close to everyone talking about this critique of Vietnam that was put out by Dr. King. And, you know, then I was thinking about this other factor is that Black Lives Matter put out a statement against the bombing or whatever, but no one in the mainstream media covered it. And I thought, you know, this just reminds me a lot of Dr. King when he came out against Vietnam and they said, oh, what was a black leader doing talking about foreign policy issues? And it just made me think that there's a huge devaluing of black political voices outside of domestic issues, by and large, to me, except for a handful of people. So, China Dickerson, I'll start with you. Do you think that's a fair parallel to make?
Sure. I think, and interestingly enough, since you said MLK, Simone Sanders was just on CNN, and she was arguing with Jeffrey Lord as he compared Trump to MLK.
The MLK of healthcare.
Yes, which is very interesting. But yeah, I think, I mean, I'm a spiritual person, so I don't think anything is coincidental. But the fact that the Black Lives Matter movement, of which I haven't heard a lot from recently. I'm not sure if that's intentional or not. But yeah, I think it's interesting that in the wake of what's been happening with the bombing in Afghanistan and then in Syria, we're encountering again another Republican president thinking it's okay to just drop bombs like it's a party. And so we need to continue to speak out about it. It's another Vietnam.
Jamal Muhammad, what do you think about some of those thoughts? I mean, it just seems so relevant to me that here we are 50 years later. And yet again, it's just like, you know, this is the most well-known social movement that in the country, like last year, that's all everyone could talk about. But then they make a statement about Syria. And it's as if, like, on that issue, it doesn't matter at all what they think.
First of all, you know, I listened to that speech again. Just on the way over here, because I hadn't listened to it in a couple of years. I've listened to it many times over the years. And I've always proclaimed that that's the speech that got him killed, all right, ironically. It's someone who lived as a pacifist who was murdered. But in the speech, every time I listen to it, it enlightens me even more because, you know, he spoke about how it was okay when he talked about nonviolence here in America. In people protesting and when he was bombed himself and people wanted to respond violently. And he said no. And he said that's not the way to do it. You know, Molotov cocktails and rifles aren't going to solve it. That was okay. But then it was okay to go and bomb brown children over in Vietnam. And then you look at right now what's happening in Syria and in Afghanistan. we have this so-called mother of all bombs that was just the first time it's ever been leashed out. Mm-hmm. And I've always said that, you know, you don't spend billions of dollars on something that you're not going to use. Mm. But you got to find a reason to use it.
Right.
You have to find an excuse to use it. And a good friend of mine up in Pittsburgh, my hometown, we were talking about, you know, the Syria attacks and now in Afghanistan and how, you know, they had to find some type of excuse. And, you know, we know for a fact that there have been false flag operations in, you know, in that America has used to justify going to war. And you always have to question it. Of course, the response from the far right usually is going to be, oh, conspiracy theorists. But the fact is that human lives is human lives, whether it's on American soil or any other soil. And so it becomes hypocritical when the result that we can, that we quote unquote say is going to get peace is to use war or to be violent. And yet we have right here, once again, on American soil, people dying here. Mm. And yet the response is not to attack violently here on American soil on people that are killing people here in America. But over there, it's okay. And I think the other thing is that it also calms down certain people that are like, you know, we need to be tougher. We need to be more aggressive against our so quote unquote enemy. So, you know, it's a bunch of hypocrisy, basically.
Mm-hmm. You know, Ava DuVernay, who made the movie Selma, also made some comments. Didn't see those anywhere. But I think, I mean, Brian, it just, to me, it speaks to the sort of overall whitewashing of King anyway. I mean, every Martin Luther King Day parade in the country has a military color guard leading it off.
Yeah,
how about that?
No, there's a, I was actually thinking about this in terms of the first Persian Gulf War, which when the red line or whatever it was that, that Bush put down, the actual bombing of Iraq started on the 22nd of January, and they gave them till the 20th to pick that as the deadline. And I remember Stevie Wonder saying, like, why would you pick Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday as the date that you would set up as the red line? And there always seems to be this little correlation of peace builders, you know, and I think that where King became extremely extremely dangerous. You know, I think the militancy of nonviolent movement is kind of overlooked. I think we only sort of, the whitewashing of him completely is something that we were talking about. The Jeffrey Lords of the world talking about MLK at every turn is just ludicrous. I think the most dangerous thing that King's did was the Vietnam speech and then standing up for workers of all colors in Memphis. And then the idea of the Poor People's March. Once you start to, like, create those sort of lines that cross race, once you start seeing, like, once Filipino, like, farm workers start identifying with Latino farm workers, once black industrial workers in a car manufacturing start to identify with their Polish and Italian and Irish peers, then you start to get real change. And I think that that is absolutely where King was moving, because he saw the energy that you saw on white college campuses towards, you know, fighting against the war in Vietnam. But you didn't have any organization.
Right.
The one thing that King brought better than almost any other group was organization. And he was able to attract all sorts of people who were fringe sort of militants of the time. The Stokely Carmichaels of the world were drawn in by him. And so I think that you imagine that suddenly, like, you had Berkeley or you had University of Michigan all suddenly, like, folding into Martin Luther King's army.
Yeah, well, we're
That's a
take,
scary, scary proposition.
We're going to take a break, but we're going to come back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we continue to be joined by Jamal Muhammad, Brian Weaver, and China Dickerson. And we left off actually having a conversation a little bit about the legacy of King in the wake of the Syria bombings, the sort of the non-entity of people like Black Lives Matter and Ava DuVernay, Black voices speaking out, not really being heard and not really being valued in a similar way. But China, let me also ask you this to sort of advance the ball here on this question. I saw a poll the other day. 33% of Democrats, only 33% of Democrats before Trump's Syria strike. So a relatively small number. 67% then would have been against, more or less what you'd expect. But then the first thing I thought to myself was, well, wait a second. Why aren't 67% of Democrats in Congress speaking out against it? I mean, it seems like a huge disconnect when an almost two-thirds majority of the people in the party are saying, like, yeah, I didn't think that was a good idea. But I think two Democratic representatives, Ted Lieu and Tulsi Gabbard, have – I mean, other people have said we should talk about it. But only two have really come out and said, like, this was wrong.
So the distinction is – I was having this conversation with a friend of mine. I think people – one, this just adds to Trump's list of things I said I would do. So looks good for him when it comes to 2020 election. But I think most folks actually agree that something should be done because Obama has gotten a lot of criticism, particularly saying in the history books, this will go down as like his, I don't know, Rwanda or like the fact that he did not.
Who said that?
There are people who are saying that.
Oh, okay.
And so, I mean, millions of people have been displaced. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. This is not like...
Yeah, but I mean, it's not like Obama. Well, first of all, now you want me to get into Clinton and Rwanda, which is a whole other...
No, but I'm just saying it happened during Obama's presidency. And so what you... The numbers, speaking to the percentages you said, people do think that Syria is a mess and that something has to be done because the pictures of the children dying and the refugee situation. So for the most part, people agree that this is like Rwanda or like, I don't know, South Africa. There have been comparisons made. I think what the Democrats are disagreeing with is his approach, the fact that he did something so huge in such a very large, bad situation and did not consult Congress. Democrats, like Republicans, even though they don't want to admit this, are elitists and need you to kiss their ring. Mm. And he did not do that before he went into Syria and then this bomb on Afghanistan. And so they're upset about it. But I think most people agree Syria is a problem.
Well, Brian, you have on the shirt.
I was wondering if anyone's going to notice.
Of the YPG, the main Kurdish force there, the key element of the Syrian Democratic Forces, playing a major role in the offensive on Raqqa. So your thoughts on what I just raised there?
I think that, I mean, from an American standpoint, I think that Syria has really sort of no upside for the U.S. involvement. It was an easy thing for Trump to send. I think it was a classic Trump move. Probably that bombing an Air Force base that's not even like the prime Air Force base for the Syrian government probably could have taken 10 Tomahawk missiles at most. No, we're going to send 60 of them. What? Only 59? Well, first, shoot them all. Shoot them all. We're going to give them the biggest, the most. In the northern part of Syria where the YPG, where Turkmen, where Christian militias have all sort of formed into this secular Syrian Democratic Force, which now is like essentially surrounded Raqqa, the capital of ISIS. For the longest time, you've essentially had the YPG doing this with like almost infield rifles and bayonets. If anyone looks back in time to about a year ago to when ISIS was completely surrounding Kobani, it was a very weird time because you actually had Turkey allow the Peshmerga from Iraq come through their territory and come in and help the YPG fight off ISIS. Mm-hmm. Since that time, Turkey's completely turned on the SDF. They invaded into Syria to create this buffer zone. A lot of the people that are in the Free Syrian Army were formerly linked with al-Qaeda. You don't have this sort of secular army that's sort of looking to topple Assad. You even have Alawite groups that were looking to be part of an FSA that aren't welcome within many aspects of the FSA. And so in that sense, it's like there's really sort of no good opportunity, I think, for the United States to do it. And it's kind of a feeble attempt. It was something that was obviously to bolster up your allies to sort of make the American public think that you're doing something. Everybody seemed to praise, oh, he seemed so presidential doing it because this is what presidents do.
Brian Williams.
The interesting thing that I thought in this was in that same poll, it's only a 3% jump from 34% of Democrats saying that they supported Trump doing it. And it was 37% that said that they agreed with Obama doing it.
Yeah.
Flip to look at Republicans and what they are. It went from like under 30 for Obama using force against Syria, and then over 60.
Yeah. A little opportunism Hypocrite. There.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so I do think that there is a moral ground of sort of people sort of saying there is no winning element within the Syrian government. I my own personal view is like, I think that like if you've been victims of ISIS and you've been victims from the Turks and from the previous Iraqi governments, I think the Kurds and the Christian militias definitely were like, you know, we need to move towards a more secular democratic sort of country. Mm-hmm. But when you end up with whatever sort of truth and reconciliation that comes out of the Syrian thing, their voices, because they haven't been even allowed to be in the peace talk, even though they seem to be the only group that's kind of winning on the ground right now.
Yeah, so you don't think because of the numbers of people who've been displaced and then have died that there would have been, I hate to quote a Republican, but like humanitarian reason for
right,
us
to protect us, what
so,
you're saying.
So, yeah. I mean, I think there's difference, but that, I mean, if we want to create a buffer zone, if you want to go in and essentially do what Turkey has done, mm-hmm. which is go in and create a space within the country where anyone who wants to flee the war can come into this area, then I think but that's going to require not 59 Tomahawk missiles.
Oh, right.
That's going
right.
to require
well, but in Jamal, isn't
tens
that the question,
of thousands
too?
Of American
I
soldiers
mean,
on the
lots
ground.
Of American right. troops, a no-fly zone, a potential right. of shooting down Russian planes.
Right.
And I think some people would argue, you know, if there's a right to protect, I mean, how does that go the other way either? I mean, certainly the rebels have committed quite a number of atrocities on their own, many of them Idlib, which is where this gas attack, you know, whatever happened there, whatever, someone got poisoned by something, that whole area is an unbelievable letter people should read in The Nation of a guy from Idlib, a journalist from mid last year, completely run and controlled by the al-Nusra Front, people who are saying they want to genocide all Shia. So, I mean, it's a complicated issue on multiple levels. So I say, to some degree, isn't that part of the issue? I mean, I think America as a country and this idea of American exceptionalism, which is like, there must be something America can do to improve this situation. But it's like, I mean, all of those situations where America's like, we're going to do this, it always makes the situation worse. And this belief, though, in the country that, like, whatever you think about any particular action, there's some action that we can take when, you know, maybe that's not prudent.
So, you know, the quote-unquote locker room talk has been that we, ironically, were banning people from this country from mm-hmm. coming here, and now all of a sudden we care about mm-hmm. those people. And that's been the big conversation that right. I've been hearing out on the streets and so forth. It's like, well, wait a minute. We, you know, as soon as he got in, it was like, we're going to ban these nations. And this is one of them.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And now we care all of a sudden about their so-called citizens, the same people that we didn't want in this country. And that's been the biggest thing for me. It's just like, it's amazing how us as a country, meaning America, we are supposed to be the savior and police of the world. Yet at the same time, the response is always violent.
Right.
And so once again, the hypocrisy that comes out of this is just that you got his approval rating goes up.
Yeah.
Sure.
Like so many other presidents when we bomb someone.
Yeah. Right.
Like that's always the solution to a certain population in this country that if we go in, we drop some bombs on a so-called threat that and it's usually somewhere in the Middle East or Africa, then you've done something versus facing the issues of education here in America, healthcare here in America, of homelessness in America, all these things that need to be treated right now in America. And
so you're a pacifist? You don't think we should ever bomb?
No, I'll pacifist. Quickly. But I'm going to pass a fist at someone who swings at me first. And that's my thing is, it's like, we got enough problems at home, yet we can't seem to stay out of the Middle East for some reason. And we got to keep fighting these people. The FBI admitted that there was an infiltration of white supremacists in the police departments of America that still hasn't been totally addressed.
Right.
That has led to what we obviously have been, you know, the people in this room have fought against police brutality, and that's not a priority in this country. Mm-hmm. But some people over in these countries that we consider to be the enemy that was created to identify this war on terrorism, we can go and bomb those people, and we can spend billions of dollars. We can use all these fighter jets and all these missiles. I mean, who came up with the number 59?
Your president.
You know what I mean?
It did seem like it kind of came out of nowhere.
While he was eating chocolate cake.
No, and golfing. Well, what kind of like crazy, just like macabre, like you just with the president of China eating chocolate cake and it's like, hey, by the way, dude, we just sent like 59 missiles into your allies thing and like blew them up and we got an armada coming in North Korea. But like, you know, finish your cake.
Just finish your cake.
This is the best cake.
Right.
It's the greatest cake. My favorite part of the entire thing was that he could talk like very eloquently about how amazing this chocolate cake was, but then he couldn't remember what country it was that he won when he was talking to Maria Bartolomeo. It's like, oh yeah, we sent 59 missiles to Iraq. And she's like, you mean Syria?
Serious,
whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. The cake.
Them.
You should have seen the cake.
Yeah. I mean, it was, the whole thing was unbelievable. I mean, to me, the bigger thing was the media piece. I mean, on Brian Williams, the beauty, the power, the missile, Fareed Zakaria. I mean, like, you can't, like, I mean, what? Like, what? I don't know what you think about this, China, but I mean, I just thought that an unbelievable abdication of basic human decency, but of the role of the media and like digging into this, it's like the man within 10 minutes, you're praising him. You didn't even, obviously a lot of these people spent zero time even deciding what they think. It was just immediate rally around the flag.
No, but I think to the point I was making earlier, I mean, folks who we would think are on our team, Fareed Zakaria, Christine Amanpour.
Fareed Zakaria is on your team. You keep him.
Well, Brian Williams.
Christine Amanpour.
Generally, we see them as, and Christian particularly, as her more of a journalist, not really inserting her opinion. But a lot of them this last week have been like, yeah, we needed to do something in Syria. This might not have been it, but Syria is a major humanitarian problem. So I think this is actually not something that's a Democrat-Republican issue. Is more of a folks who think you should go into war for humanitarian reasons and folks who think you should not.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair.
I think the problem becomes is then what's
if it
the,
is humanitarian, so, but, yes. but
what's,
I'm with
the,
you.
What's the second? What's the second part of it? Because that's the part that, like, I think is where rubber meets the road. Mm-hmm. It's easy to sort of say, like, all right, well, we're anti-Assad and mm-hmm. we're going to go after his bases. So, are we now going to back some mm-hmm. element within the FSA? Because if we don't have any sort of people that we're like advocating for that they should come in and take power, or are we trying to like pivot and say to the Syrian secular military saying like, you need to get rid of this dude because he's yeah. making terrible decisions for you guys. Or do you double down on the SDF and then say, hey, Turkey, we're sorry, but we're going to back the forces that are half of them are maybe affiliated with the PKK who are like you're a number one sort of enemy.
And now you got McMaster saying he wants to put 50,000 on it. But I want to switch gears here just a touch as well. And I mean, I know it's lighten the mood here since we've been talking about terrible things, the Pepsi commercial.
Oh.
It's on so many different levels. But I just also have to preface for the audience that this week's episode of Empire, sponsored by Pepsi. But China, you look like you want to get in there, so go ahead.
I was heartbroken. So I watched this show on TV called To Tell the Truth. Oh, Alec Baldwin is the host.
Yes.
And I think Alec Baldwin is so hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
And he just defended Kylie Jenner on
Kendall.
Whichever. Same one of
thing.
Them. Same thing.
Them.
They're individuals.
Those people. He just defended her on Twitter saying she's young, she doesn't really know, get with her management, like her management did her wrong. And in one vein, I'm like, yeah, she's like rich, wealthy, she doesn't pay attention to these things, she doesn't care, she just wanted her money. The management team should have known better. That's why you have a management team and PR people. But she has to be held accountable when she's doing something so politically, culturally relevant.
Right.
Now, if it was something as, you know, sober as a music video that talked about big booties or something. But this, you're playing on black boys and men, black people mm-hmm. being shot, brown people being shot in the street. And the fact that they did not debrief her on that, or that she did not ask for a briefing on, okay, what is this commercial really about, says a lot about her. And I particularly am very surprised that Chris did not have Chris anything Jenner. To say about this, because she is a very intelligent, she's like the bad witch, but she's a very intelligent person, so you would have thought she would have known better.
Kardashian
she's
curse
very
moving
calculated.
Into new areas.
Yeah, the moral compass of America, Kris Jenner. Yeah, I'm with you on this.
Kris Jenner, y'all don't hate. That lady is, she's built an empire.
Well, the FX O.J. Simpson movie put a slightly different spin on that. That's
she's
true.
She's rich.
Well, Jamal Muhammad. Please go on here on Pepsi. Yeah, and maybe
theoretically, Nino Brown was rich too.
So. Correct. Correct.
But I agree with what China said in holding her accountable. And I mean, who in America has not recognized in the last 4 or 5 years that there's been an issue between black people protesting and the police? It's been national headlines, is mm-hmm. what I'm saying, ever mm-hmm. since, especially since the death of Trayvon Martin, rest mm-hmm. in peace, mm-hmm. that it's been, you know, one after another, after another, after another, after another, and there's been so many protests going around the country. So she couldn't have been totally ignorant of the significance and the sensitivity that exists mm-hmm. with us protesting and marching. And then we saw in Ferguson and in Baltimore how volatile this became. And so for her to decide to do that commercial was insensitive in itself. But more importantly, Pepsi, to go with the commercial and to agree with this whole thing, that to trivialize it as if, oh, you know, really all we need to do is sit on some Pepsi and this will calm everything down. I mean, that says that, you know, Mike Brown, Tamir Rice, Trayvon Martin, John Crawford, all these people, it could have been solved if
with a Pepsi,
or just people just calming down. And what that does is that trivializes the history
of what's going
on, of what's been happening.
Brian Weaver.
First of all, the world is made for those that aren't burdened with self-awareness. Right. So okay. There's none of these conversations were happening
correct.
In the Jenner household or in the executives of Pepsi.
Right.
You can
and
see,
the Pepsi CEO is like an Indian woman, too.
You
that's
can
relevant.
See that. Mm-hmm. You can see that by how am I going to like break the shackles of this awful modeling career and join the people in the streets? I'm
going
to take off my blonde wig and then hand it to the first black woman I see.
Yeah.
Anybody who sees that part in the commercial,
right.
That's A number one, the best part of that entire ad.
Right.
What? Hold my wig. Skip the hold my beer thing. Hold my wig should be the hashtag for America.
Why are we upset with the black and the brown people in the video? That's what we should really be like.
I'm upset with that woman. That woman should have smashed her square in the face.
She definitely should have walked off.
Pepsi writes big checks.
Yes,
that's the other one. The only thing that's actually been culturally relevant to this entire thing is that it's actually like gave like a really good skit to Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
And I think that every time that we end up with something that actually sort of shifts the underpinning of what is sort of the social culture of America, I think that people that aren't part of that are trying to scramble to figure out how they can be relevant in that world. And so this to them was like, how can we pay homage to Black Lives Matter or protests in the streets or the Million Women March kind of thing? Mm-hmm. How can we do that? We'll link in our product to being part of the cause.
Yeah.
And it's just it's kind of laughable. I mean, it's something that is you're trying to, you know,
it
you're
is.
Trying to commercialize something that is organic and generic and has a much larger point.
Indeed. Well, we're going to take another break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik here in Washington, D.C. I am your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we're continuing our conversation here with Brian Weaver, the founder and executive director of Hoops to Grata, China Dickerson, the executive director of the District of Columbia Young Democrats, and Jamal Muhammad, a.k.a. DJ One Love, who's the host of The Love Lounge on We Act Radio, all frequent guests, all great guests, and we left off discussing the commercialization of protest. So now there is this other controversy. So One United Bank, which is a black-owned bank in L.A., which has a pretty bad record, unfortunately, the founder has been in a lot of sort of trouble and done different things. He's living a high lifestyle. The bank itself has had some negative practices even towards its own community. They have partnered with Black Lives Matter L.A. and I guess Visa, who is their loan servicer, to put out this Black Lives Matter credit card. Now, Jared Ball, who's also a good friend of the show, he raised this issue yesterday, and he raised a couple issues. If y'all know Jared Ball, one, that the black buying power thing is actually a myth, and it's a marketing thing, not a realistic amount of money that black people have. So this perpetuates that, one. But two, that how does this actually empower black people, since it's really putting money in the pockets of Visa and interest rates in the pocket of this bank that, even though it's a quote-unquote black bank, hasn't really shown the type of commitment to make you think it's much more than just a handful of people getting paid off of that and using sort of black banking as a hashtag. So, Jamal, I'll start with you. I mean, it's sort of there's this broader phenomenon now of sort of the bank black, and that's what Black Lives Matter LA is saying. Well, this is a piece of that. But I think some people feel it's a little bit of it's like a guy with a crying face on the front, a little bit exploitative and on the part of these corporations.
Well, it is exploitative. And that's what's troublesome about it, because you were just bringing up, you know, Jared bringing up the myth of the black buying power. And that the issue is that when it comes to America being a capitalistic country, it's the icon of capitalism in the world. You have racial issues. You have racial divide that this country was built on. And this country became powerful because of involuntary servitude, a.k.a. slavery, free labor, that empowered people to become extremely wealthy. And we have banks that exist that are wealthy because they own slaves. Their previous owners or ancestors of those banks owned slaves. And yet here we have this situation where it's an economic situation of empowerment that Black people, I'm going to just say it, are weak as a group of people because they don't economically have power that they should because they don't collectively invest into their own. And because of that, unlike other races that do use their collective money power to get representatives in Congress to address their needs, Black people use votes. But that's not really empowering because, you know, cash rules everything around us, cream.
That's right.
Basically. So when you have a situation like this, it comes off as, okay, we're helping you, but the truth is, you know, we're really exploiting a movement to get people to sign on to our bank. And you don't have to do that because, you know, I've been working, helping out with Industrial Bank right here in D.C. Mm-hmm. to get people to open up accounts. As a matter of fact, my lady just opened up one today, literally. Okay. And she had been trying to do it for a while, but she had been so busy and she finally opened up a business account with Industrial Bank. And I know I'm personally friends with the vice president, Patricia Mitchell. And I've, you know, encouraged people to go and open up and put your money into their bank because they put back into the community and it makes it easier for people to get loans and to, you know, for businesses and homes and things like that, that they might not be able to get elsewhere. And that affects the power that you have as a people. But when you do something like this, it becomes, once again, it trivializes, first of all, the Black Lives Matter movement. And it trivializes that. And then it trivializes, to me, One United Bank's purpose of you know, banking Black. It might as well be a Pepsi move as far as I'm concerned. I mean, honestly, so I have a problem with that because they don't have to do that in order to get people to invest into the bank. Because right now, Black investment into the banks has been, you know, rising for the last couple of years because a lot of people have woken up and realized, you know what, we've been losing banks just like we've been losing HBCUs left and right, and we need to put back into our own community so that we can, quote unquote, help ourselves. And then you go with a move like this. I'm actually disgusted by it.
Yeah, I was pretty shocked. Speaking of HBCUs, China Dickerson, Howard University grad, great university.
H-U.
I just happened to have gone there, as many of us as well. Brian Weaver also. China, what do you think about this?
I think it's ironic that the face on the card is a weeping Black person because, it should be. I am usually one of those Black folks that take a certain amount of encouraging and research before I buy into whatever a Black person gets on Twitter or Facebook and says we should start doing. And I remember when the Bank Black thing first came out.
So you didn't get Verizon because of DeRay?
No.
Sorry, had to do it.
And I was not going
to
say his. I did not.
Or the Rainbow Doritos. You didn't buy the Rainbow Doritos? I'm just throwing him on blast because he came at Pepsi, and I'm like, dog, you promote more brands than anybody else on Twitter. Yeah. I'm sorry, but go ahead, Jonathan.
And so I think what we need to say a name that is controversial. I was listening to this YouTube video. DJ Vlad was interviewing Brother Polite, and Brother Polite gave this very awesome explanation of how banks work, particularly with mortgages. And, you know, people say, oh, Black people need to buy homes. This is the way to go. But it was this long thing. But I think Black and brown folks have to better educate themselves on what matters. And I think what we need to be investing our money in more is education. And in schools, though I'm not a fan of this whole choice argument and, you know, that we should essentially ignore public schools and create more charter schools and voucher programs, I do think there is something to be said about homeschooling and about charter schools that are created by intelligent and authentically caring Black and brown folks to educate our children how to do things, and that the easy way isn't just invest in a Black bank. Because when that first started happening, the buy black, bank Black hashtag, people act like that was the solution to all of our problems. And I'm like, there's no way, because I don't know what percentage or how these banks work as far. Who are the underwriters? Are some of the underwriters for these loans white people? Like, it just doesn't. It's too easy.
Well,
of a
DJ, DJ Vlad is white for that matter. And
yes,
he's got the most popular urban, you know, like TV network or whatever.
We have to be careful in what we see as
that's
easy solutions.
That's why it's not necessary, because like going back to Industrial Bank, knowing for a fact that they have for the last 70 plus years invested into the D.C. black community to help black businesses. We know their track record,
right.
You know, yeah. To help black people get homes when they couldn't get loans to get it from anywhere else. That's the whole point of it. But when you do something like this, to me, you're no different than Pepsi or Doritos or McDonald's or anybody else, because it's not necessary. You've seen a rise in black people investing back into the black owned banks. So why do you got to pander for citizens to get the, you know, to open up accounts by using such, once again, a volatile circumstance? We've monetized black movement and protesting and the whole issue of the violence in between police and black people out there on the streets. We monetized
it. Right. Brian Weaver.
So about 1993, there was a malt liquor that was called Crazy Horse malt liquor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will say this, the image of Crazy Horse on the bottle was actually very, like, sort of prideful, not looking like the Cleveland Indians mascot.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, back of the story of on the back of the bottle was sort of talk about the great pride of Crazy Horse and what he meant to the Lakota and to Native peoples throughout.
Ironic.
But it was on a bottle of malt liquor.
Right.
Right. So you could get your lesson on the importance of Crazy Horse
mm-hmm.
and have a depiction of like a positive image of a Native. But it was on a bottle of malt liquor.
Of all things.
That seems super offensive. Somehow I find this more offensive.
Yeah.
Like, we're talking really about a movement that really started out of young men of color losing their lives in situations
right.
that are impossible to explain. Trayvon Martin, you cannot explain to anyone else in the world and have it make any sort of right. sense, right?
Yeah.
And yet we keep trying to justify ourselves. Like, we keep trying to, like, manipulate our minds to somehow to make it seem like that this is a rational thing. Oh, well, you know, the Stanger Graham, well, you know, this is like, he was a kid in a sweatshirt in the rain with Skittles and a bottle of iced tea.
Yeah.
Killed by somebody who's not a cop.
Yeah.
Right.
There's no way that you can actually, like, wrap your head around it other than that. And then the guy ends up being serially violent,
yeah.
has had multiple altercations with weapons, since. Shouldn't have since. I mean, it's
he
ridiculous.
He got beat up by a guy with a Confederate flag tattoo on his arm.
Yeah.
For saying something racist in that restaurant, the guy who punched him.
Mm.
It's a crazy story.
So just like we were talking about earlier, I mean, this is something here where the whole the sort of pop culture and sort of the sort of feelings of folks, you know, are we now going to have like Bernie Sanders come out and sort of like, you know, the revolution is going to be like a Coca-Cola sort of product kind of thing. I kind of feel
he
like that's
better.
Where we are. But at some point, it just gets co-opted.
Oh, right. Absolutely.
Right? So now right. we're just going to have some dude who kind of looks like Bernie Sanders.
Right.
And you're going to have feel the burn. It could totally be. Oh, I Cheetos, if you're listening. Flaming Cheetos.
Yes.
Just get an old man in like a suit and feel the burn. But you get, you know.
He can walk down like a set of like Brooklyn 1930s, you know,
God.
And just they have all the fresh fruits, all the fresh vegetables being trucked
yeah.
in from the farm. You know what I really just need, and then somehow come up with something with flaming Doritos. People would like that. People would
feel
like
the revolution.
Cheetos.
I mean, really, honestly, it's
feel the revolution.
You know, and it becomes something where, like, I mean, there are all of these national brands and him doing it, where black, Latino, you know, sort of insular communities. You see it in Chicago. You mm-hmm. can see it here in D.C. Where we actually do have buying power and sort of like power locally is in a sort of the micro level.
That's right.
So, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, you know, I always sort of question D.C. is notoriously bad for, like, trying to build a series of laws that sort of mess with small businesses.
Yeah.
But if you were to look at who the majority of small businesses over the last 20 years have been, it's mostly been African-American, to a lesser degree, Latino owners. That's the mm-hmm. best way for them to sort of make a move into the middle class. When you end up having larger companies that sort of, like, try to co-opt elements of a movement and try to say, like, hey, come to us,
yeah.
as opposed to Industrial Bank, you know, come to Visa.
Because
mm-hmm. yeah. you know that Visa is, like, really what we're talking about in this. Like,
yeah.
it doesn't really
yeah.
matter about the black
no,
bank involved.
Because
it's like,
and
them.
The Visa logo is so
you and
huge.
Me together
they
are
going to
get that. You and me together are going to get that 34% that person's
yeah.
going to put up there.
Right.
You know what? We'll give 1% of that to a offshoot of Black Lives Matter.
Right.
What would have been a better commercial for all of these, particularly these white-led or white-founded companies, just on a blank, like, black screen and white letters say, we donated $2 million to X, Y, and Z, education or whatever for oppressed people. Mm-hmm. That would get people to go out and buy Pepsi. When the Uber and Lyft thing happened in New York around when Trump issued the Muslim ban, people immediately switched over to Lyft instead of Uber, even though they do the same darn thing.
Right.
But people immediately switched over to Lyft because Lyft immediately came out, didn't do a commercial. It was just one letter that said, Uber's crazy. We're putting in $2 million.
Mm-hmm. It was smart.
It worked.
Yeah.
It was smart.
I mean, you think back to like the, you guys can't, but you know, if you go to YouTube and look in the 70s commercial for the Buy the World a Coke.
I remember that.
I don't know that.
Yeah, I remember.
So it's like it comes at the tail end of the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. Lots of social strife. The capital is surrounded by barricades during the mid-70s. Coca-Cola comes out with a, like, you know, I'd like to buy the world a Coke ad. And it's like people from all over sort of joining hands and singing songs.
I remember
little
that.
Kumbaya-ish, right?
Yeah.
There was obviously an underlining to a political statement that they were making or trying to, like, co-opt.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, we're going to give a cop in riot gear, although there was no helmet in the riot gear.
Yeah.
I didn't want to bring give a handsome cop without riot gear in a riot of Pepsi.
Yeah.
Coke just sort of instead just like does a little song and a little ditty that obviously like is trying to say like, look, let's try to get back together. Let's try to come together.
Yeah.
Like, that one was offensive to some people because it was like, oh, you're trying to co-opt the movement.
Mm-hmm.
But at least it wasn't like so completely in your face. Like what we're here, hold my wig kind of like I'm taking this over.
Well, you know, Jamal, one thing that's interesting to me is how, is speaking of this, DJ Vlad, is how hip hop becomes the transmission for a lot of, because you know who's one of the main consultants for these Fortune 500 companies on just these type of ads like Pepsi, Steve Stout.
Yeah.
That's after he got hit over the head with that champagne bottle by Puffy. I guess he said like, I'm done with the record business. I'm out from Interscope. And now he's like one of the most famous. No, he keeps a low profile, but Sprite, McDonald's, all of them, he helps them use like the hip hop branding to sort of, you know, make their stuff cool.
I still find it offensive because me being a DJ and a lover of hip hop, not rap culture, but hip hop culture, which when hip hop originally was formed, it was the voice of the street so that people could actually hear our story that wasn't getting put out there, just like some of these stories today aren't getting put out there about circumstances, the good and the bad. I like this big three Big Mac thing going on right now.
And
to me, I'm like, man, you might as well put on blackface.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm honestly offended by it because everything is it's marketed towards black people, brown people. Go out there. It's always something about dancing and shaking your behind and getting you to buy. Yet there are so many other things that you could use to sell your product. Like you were saying, Coke didn't go the route of directly putting some individual out there that represents a painful moment. They went like, hey, let's come together. It's still Coke, but at least they was like, yo, hey, can we unite as a world? And we're all human beings so that you can buy my product versus, you know, hey, buy my product and it'll solve your problem of 400 or 500 years of oppression.
Maybe they didn't know. I'm sure Coke, let's just, you know, keep it real. I'm sure that if Coke had thought of that in the time, like, you know, instead of throwing a Molotov cocktail, why don't we throw, like, full Cokes at the police?
Right. You know, somebody was like, no. I don't know if you saw the Saturday Night Live skit on the whole Pepsi thing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, no, this is not a good decision. You know, everybody who we called was like, no, you don't want to touch that.
These people get paid so much money, though, to make these decisions. I don't understand.
You're in the echo chamber. You're in the echo chamber. It sounds so great.
Yeah.
It's like, and, you know, I want to know
who
it was.
We're going to put a cello on his back. People don't even think black people play classical music.
Yeah.
We're blazing ground, guys.
Yeah, so I think I still, from my lens, it's all offensive.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are so many ways that you could promote a positive image and sell your product that they don't use.
You know who really took it in the Pepsi ad is Skip Marley. Skip Marley has been the gateway drug for reggae for my daughter. My daughter is 10 and is all about pop music, and Skip Marley has a CD out with Katy Perry.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly now I'm able to like go to like Bob Marley, and then from Bob Marley we can go like every other sort of form of reggae, right?
Okay, a little steel pulse in there.
So Skip Marley is the music that's in that Pepsi ad. And like actually it's a fairly good song. I'd heard the song before. I was like, oh, this is great. And then they put it in the Pepsi ad and I'm just like, yeah, we're gonna delete that one off the tracks list right there. Like that's not, I mean, and that's the thing is like they went way out of their way to try to figure out a way.
Way out of their way.
Let's find like, you know, hey, it's a Marley. He's got cred. He's Bob Marley's grandson. Yeah. He has a song that's about uprising. Let's pick that out. You know, I think they kind of failed on who they were looking for. I'm sure they went through maybe like, you know, 10 black actresses and sort of like, hey, you know, what do you think? What do you think? Hell no.
One thing I know about white folks, so I actually think that there was a black person in that room. I think, or two, or three.
They called
black people into that room that they had never spoken to before in the office. They went and got the secretary from the front desk and was like, listen to this, what do you think? And she was like,
how much?
Yes.
Right, yeah.
I think they got cosigned.
There's also this element, we never really want to talk about it, but there is this element, and this happens like in sort of every minority community within the United States. There are Latinos within a room, there are African Americans within a room who've maybe, you know, who maybe have gone to Duke or gone to Harvard Business School. Yeah. And when they get into that room, they may be looking through a black lens, but it's a black lens that we don't necessarily understand because they're coming from an entitlement sort of place, a place that's a different sort of world.
Yeah. Found you bamboozled.
Which, it's not white face. I mean, it's not black face. It's just light skinned actors with darker.
Be careful, Brian.
I have to tell you, Mos Def and Jada Pinkett Smith really just stole the show in that one. I'm going to call you Big Black Africa. Anyway, just watch Bamboozled if you've never heard of it. Fantastic movie. One of Spike Lee's best. But thank you so much to all of our guests, Jamal Muhammad, China Dickerson, Brian Weaver. And thank you all for listening here to our 200th show on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. We'll see you next time.
By any means necessary.